literature, philosophy, and metapolitics from the time between orders.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Interregnum, the official podcast of Arctos Media. I'm John Bruce Leonard, the editor-in-chief of Arctos, and I'm standing in today for Charles Lyons, who unfortunately was not able to be present. We're here today with Decadent Perspective, and we're going to be having a conversation on Julius Evola. We're joined, as ever, by Martin Locker, assistant editor-in-chief. Martin, could you say a word, please?
Hello to everyone.
And we're introducing today Decadent Perspective. We'll be getting into some of Decadent's background and his thoughts on Julius Evola. Decadent is a YouTuber, and he has a Twitter account which he keeps up with the present events of the day from a very unique perspective. So, Decadent, could you please say hello to everyone?
Hello, everyone. I'm glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you on. So, as stated, today we are going to be investigating and conversing on Julius Evola, the great traditionalist philosopher of the past century. This is going to be a very general conversation. We're not going to be focusing too specifically on any one of Evola's books. Any one of his books could easily be the subject for an entire podcast, but today we're simply going to be talking about the man and his thought in general. Part of the reason, of course, for our concentrating on Evola, beyond, of course, the simple reason that it's always good to think about Evola and his perspectives, is that Arctos has recently been moving through its campaign to publish translations, original translations of some of the hitherto untranslated works of Julius Evola. We have gotten through three of the four titles. That includes Recognitions, Evola's last book, The Bow and the Club, which is one of his later works, The Myth of the Blood, which was just recently published, and The Mask and Face of Contemporary Spiritualism, which will be coming out soon. We'll have a little bit more to say about these works either as we go along or at the end of the podcast, but I encourage everyone to check out the Arctos homepage and to look into these works and to buy a copy of them, because they are very important books, both within the context of Julius Evola's oeuvre and also just in general. They're very important works. So, with that, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Decadent Perspective for a little while. And to begin with, Decadent, if you could just give our listeners an introduction to yourself, what it is you do, and to lead into the Evola question, how you came across Evola to begin with.
All right. Well, as John said previously, I run a YouTube channel. I don't post that often, but the channel mainly consists of book reviews and analyzing certain right-wing ideas from a radical traditionalist Nietzschean philosophical Jungarian perspective of all kinds. It's rather eclectic, I like to think. And I got into Evola when I was about 19, which was about 3 to 4 years ago. I'm 21 now, and I had heard about him after I had picked up a few copies of Spengler's works, Oswald Spengler, German conservative revolutionary thinker. And I was just completely amazed by his insight, his philosophy, and I just immediately had to know everything about this guy. I grabbed whatever I could afford at the time, and I read away. And up to now, I know enough to speak about him at great length, as well as a few other political thinkers. But Evola, I think, has been one of the biggest influences on my philosophy and my politics and my understanding of the world, life, metaphysics, etc. I mean, there's so much to learn from him on all kinds of subjects, and not just politics and philosophy, but also art, mythology, history. There's just too much to get into alone just from Evola's writings.
I think that's absolutely true. The comprehensiveness of Evola's thought is really quite bewildering sometimes. Just the sheer number of topics that he explored, and that he explored in a very profound way. Decadent, maybe as an one approach to our general conversation, you could tell us a little bit about Ebola's thought as a whole and why it's important today. So, I mean, in very general terms, what is it that Ebola proposes, and how does it have any possible relation to our lives today?
Well, I think Ebola will always remain relevant for anyone who's sort of disaffected by the world in which they live in, a world of if they feel that the life they're living and the society they inhabit is decadent and rather minimal and empty, they can certainly find something for Ebola in that. And one of the most significant points that Ebola makes throughout his works is that tradition and modernity are eternal concepts. They're not just something that happened in periods of time, that they're always there. I mean, Leszek Kolakowski, the Polish theologian, wrote an essay called Modernity on Endless Trial, in which he makes that exact same point, that modernity is as old as tradition. And so I think that way that makes his philosophy timeless. And in a way, his philosophy is quite literally timeless, because he delves into all aspects of history, and his ideas of tradition is, while unorthodox, which is ironic for a traditionalist having an unorthodox definition of traditionalism, he grabs all kinds of eclectic meanings from every civilization, from every period of history. So I think in that way it will always be relevant, and he will always be read by someone, be it a small group or a vast wave of new generations.
Right, the continuing relevance of Ebola, I think, is absolutely absolutely correct. It seems to me, and I'd like to hear your perspective on this, that Ebola presents quite possibly the most complete and the most radical opposition to modernity of any thinker of which I'm aware. The only one who comes close, well, all right, René Guénon obviously comes very close, who's a thinker in a similar strain. Other than that, Nietzsche, who certainly contributed to presenting one of the deepest critiques of modernity, but in a couple of ways, and I think Ebola perceives this, Nietzsche actually agrees with modernity, whereas Ebola, at least by his presentation, seems to be radically counter-modern in every possible way. Do you think that that's true, Decadent, or do you believe that there are ways in which Ebola actually is a modern thinker?
Well, he is by no means a modern thinker. In any way, shape, or form, he is by no means a modern thinker. And I think with that, it's his philosophy gives a sort of hindrance to current readers who are willing to read his stuff, because they might feel that he seems rather outdated or detached from the modern world, when in fact, I think it's just the opposite. Like you said, I think his critique of modernity is so powerful and so foundational and so relevant and so radical that I don't see anyone, even for people who don't like Ebola, to not learn something, at the very least, from his thought.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think that Ebola has been very, very unjustly cut out of the eye of serious scholarship. It's no surprise, because Ebola really does present a vision of the world which is so completely illiberal and opposed to our democratic way of thinking that it would be impossible, really, for them to give him the kind of voice that he actually deserves. But, one of Ebola's main themes, to get into some of the more concrete questions here, is that history works in cycles. He has a cyclical vision of history, which he takes from certain traditions across the world, also from our own Western tradition. This kind of cyclical vision of the world is to be seen in thinkers like Plato and Hesiod and the Greeks. It's also to be seen in the mythologies of Europe, both in the North and in the South. And the idea that he presents is that we are approaching the end of a cycle. And with the end of a cycle, there comes a certain kind of crumbling of the social order. This is something which is presented in various mythologies, that things begin to fall apart. And that the orders which once held everything in place and directed everything toward the heights, as he put it, begin to crumble, to disconnect, and we fall from one stage to a lower stage to a lower stage until finally we reach the very end, the rock bottom, as it were. We can't go any farther. So one half of his work is dedicated to the critique of that rock bottom and exactly what it means to be in the world that we're living in presently, which is a decadent, ruined world in which we're living kind of in the shadows of the past and in the fragments of these things that have come down to us, completely disconnected from any kind of tradition, completely disconnected from any kind of spirituality, hedonistic and materialistic. And so maybe we could begin with that aspect of his thought. What would you say about his critique of modernity? What have you garnered from it, or what have you personally gained from it?
Well, Evola's critique of modernity has a lot to do with not just a disdain for it. I mean, he's not the kind of person who would look at it and say, oh, well, this is not how I would do it, or this is not how it should be. In fact, he actually acknowledges that modernity is necessary for tradition to prevail. And I think his anti-modernity, in a way, has a sort of, in an odd way, has a sort of positive alternative to it. Whereas most people who call themselves anti-modern or anti-anything, really, is usually a negation. And Evola was very incessant in pointing that out, that his anti-modernity was not a negation, but rather an opportunity to present his views on the traditional world, the world of being rather than becoming. He uses a lot of abstract terminology, most commonly related to ancient Greek and Sanskrit terminology, as well as Latin. But yeah.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. You know, the same kind of critique is brought against Nietzsche very regularly, that he destroyed and tore down without being able to build up and construct anything new. And, you know, most of the people who bring this sort of argument, I don't believe have any right to it, because they haven't gone deeply enough into Nietzsche's thought. But Evola makes the same critique of Nietzsche, and if anyone does have a right to it, I think Evola does, because he does present a positive alternative to modernity. And in some ways, it's an alternative which is so clear and so focused in his thought that it's very tempting as a vision, at least I think for a certain kind of human being. So maybe we can move into that. What does Evola present as the alternative to modernity? What are its aspects? What are its features? What is the world of tradition, if we can try and state that as in a brief or concise way?
Oof, that's probably one of the hardest tasks you can ask of me to present.
Probably impossible.
Yes, it is.
Maybe we can begin just by some of the specifics, rather than getting to the essence of it, because, you know, Evola himself, only at the end of his life, actually wrote in a very concise way about tradition. It's one of the essays, actually, in The Bow and the Club, one of the last essays in that book, and it's an incredible distillation of his entire life's work in the tradition. And even there, he says that he's not arrogant enough to suppose that he's given a full definition of it. But maybe we can begin to give an idea of it, a sketch of it.
Sure. Well, I can try. Well, let's see. In Revolt Against the Modern World, Evola's most important work, he himself admitted that in his intellectual autobiography, The Path of Cinnabar, he defines tradition and modernity as the dualism of civilization, or in other words, what he defines as the two natures, the traditional, the modern, quality, quantity, being and becoming. And he defines, quote-unquote, becoming as an irrepressible indetermination, a sort of lack of direction, purpose, and limitation, while contrasting this to, quote-unquote, being, which Evola called asceticism, which traditionally consisted in values such as mastery over oneself, self-discipline, the sort of existence that doesn't need to be spent in search of other things or people in order to be complete and justified. And he also applies this to his analysis of history, which I think was one of the first attempts at metaphysical history or meta-history.
And then there's also the spiritual aspect over all of this, of course, which I think is the regulating principle behind Evola's entire vision, that there is a higher world toward which society should be oriented, and every individual within society should have his unique place, which participates in that orientation toward the heights. So there's a kind of thrust and a movement away from the earthbound and the concrete and the material toward something transcendent, something in a way purer and certainly more spiritual. And, you know, I think that this might actually be one of the most difficult parts of Evola's work for a lot of modern people to relate to, simply because it's the aspect that we in modernity have most totally lost. What do you think the role is of that other aspect in Evola's thought?
Well, the spiritual aspect in Evola's traditionalism, I think, is brilliantly defined once again in his book Revolt Against the Modern World, when he's talking about the caste system. So for the caste system, according to Evola, is based on two principles. Again, Evola is very keen on dualism. So he bases the caste system on two principles, the first being that everything visible and worldly is considered as the mere effects of causes of a higher order. And Evola believes that there's no such thing as a caste conflict, but an outcast conflict, which is sort of opposite of a modern class conflict. But find a better section here, where he talks about Earth, space, and time, which is, I think, Evola's most complex idea. It's very, very abstract. He says that when Evola goes through the traditional notions of space and time and Earth, he defines it as the following. So he defines time traditionally as a rhythmic series of eternal cycles, like organisms. They go through the same process, but are unique in their progression as well as follow each other. And then there's Evola's traditional definition of space, which is seen as an intense, energetic liveliness, and which produces a simultaneously magical and symbolic quality. And depending on the regions, on the civilizations, they possess their own virtues endowed with what he calls sacred intensity, and where every gesture had a meaning and gave one an integrated sense of fate and eternity. Now, both space and time are never, ever seen as indifferent or impartial as we see it today. We see time as a clock, something that moves on with regardless if you're here or not. Space, you know, as areas and just in which you just pass on through. Evola thought that everything, space, time, and Earth, all coincided with each other and complemented each other. And I think Evola used the terminology of the unity of I and not I, being and not being, and the balance of oneself and nature, which corresponds to the traditional man's intimate relationship to the earth. And so I think that's the gist of his spiritual traditionalism.
Right, that seems like an excellent summation to me. You know, returning to your initial comments regarding caste, this is one of the very interesting political points that Evola makes. There is an idea today that, a very widespread idea today, particularly on the left, but you know, it's very insidious and very generalized, that in the past, the orders that existed were authoritarian in the sense that the central authority held the entire order together by means of force. And by dint of this force, it managed to press people into their kind of submissive positions and to hold them in place. And Evola points out that this is a ridiculous way of viewing any kind of past order, that such a thing would be absolutely impossible. They didn't have the means to run around, you know, forcing people to stay in place. And, you know, nowadays we would probably try and give a subtler analysis of these past societies, saying that what really was going on is that people were being held in place by means of dogmatic religion or these sorts of social narratives, as we like to say today, which forced people into a kind of mindset, a servile mindset. But Evola's view is that in the past, people actually pertained to a whole, to an integrated whole, and their individuality was completed in that context so that they didn't actually even have the urge to break free. The idea of breaking free in a context like that would be absurd because they were as free as they were ever going to get. Freedom doesn't consist in breaking away from authority, but in pertaining to a right authority, an authority which again is oriented toward the heights. Now, the criticism that a person would in our time would make to this is that it completely abolishes any kind of individualism. It destroys the personality, right? We have this idea that the human being has to be a creative unit and has to be able to express himself in an authentic way, and that any sort of authoritarian or dictatorial or tyrannical or totalitarian or whatever you like to call it, any kind of order of this kind suppresses the personality and the creative potency of the human being. This is kind of corrupted Nietzscheanism, which is spread into our society. And what kind of a response do you think Evola would make to this objection to his thought?
Well, what he had to say completely concurs with what Nietzsche said in his Twilight of the Idols, when he said that the great malaise of modernity is restlessness, that we perceive ourselves as a peace-loving and joyful personality, when in actuality we swarm about like wasps or bees, and that one lives for the day, one lives very fast, one lives very irresponsibly. And Nietzsche ridicules this and says precisely this is called freedom, quote-unquote freedom. And I think Evola, yeah, and I think Evola probably made a better point in his book Men Among the Ruins. I believe it was published in 1953, if I'm not mistaken. But he gives a very biting critique of the competitive consumerist mindset. Most people, when quoting Evola's critique of communism, capitalism, Marxism, socialism, things like that, they usually quote his another section of Men Among the Ruins, where he says nothing is more evident than the modern capitalism is just as subversive as Marxism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think his best critique of modernity, modern consumerist society, or what Dieter Bohr called the society of the spectacle, comes from the page afterward, where he says that for Marxists, everything that exists is regarded as a superstructure. And supporters of free market economy are not inclined to be as drastic, though their standard and main concern is always the economy. And he says, all this is proof of the true pathology of our civilization. The economic factor exercises a hypnosis and a tyranny over modern man. And as often occurs in hypnosis, what the mind focuses on eventually becomes real. Modern man is making possible what every normal and complete civilization has always regarded as an aberration or as a bad joke, namely that the economy and the social problem in terms of the economy are his destiny. Thus, in order to posit a new principle, what is needed is not to oppose one economic formula with another, but instead to radically change attitudes, to reject without compromise the materialistic premises from which the economic factor has been perceived as absolute. And finally, he makes a very good point here. He's not criticizing economic theories or economic alternatives. He says, and I quote, what must be questioned is not the value of this or that economic system, but the value of economy itself.
That is an excellent quote for exemplifying his thoughts on the matter. And you know, this point really gets to the radicalism of Evola's point of view of his philosophy, of his vision of the world. We tend very often in modern times to set up these dichotomies, which by any classical and certainly any traditional standard simply do not make any sense. One of them is capitalism versus communism, particularly in the United States, but I think also much more generally than that. There's this idea that there's a fundamental opposition between the capitalist point of view and the communist point of view, the capitalist society and the communist society. And Evola actually proposes that the difference between these two is not so great as it might seem, and the difference between democracy and communism is not so great as it might seem from our perspective living in these societies, that in terms of principle, they lead toward the same end, the same result. Perhaps there's a difference in tempo with them and how fast they get to the final objective, but they're both moving in that direction. And the only way of opposing them then is to step outside completely of these kinds of false dichotomies and to perceive them from a radically different perspective, which is based on radically different principles. And this is where he returns to the tradition, trying to find these principles in a distant past, which has been largely lost to us. Although this distant past also extends up to relatively modern times in the medieval period. You know, there are several figures in that period that he considers to be of worth. But nonetheless, these principles exist in the past, and we exist in a world which is basically corrupt and which presents alternatives to us which are not real alternatives. This leads me to another point about Evola, namely that one might step away from Evola's work completely despairing about the modern world, supposing one has gone so far as to accept Evola's critique of modernity and a modern society. The picture that he presents seems at times so bleak because we're dealing with these kinds of currents, these kinds of forces and energies which are pushing us inexorably toward ends that they all agree on. And so there's a kind of a temptation to simply despair. Evola, I believe, resists this entirely. How do you think he does?
Well, for Evola, he doesn't. What he advocates, especially in his book Ride the Tiger, as a cure for the modern world, he advocates a sort of differentiation of the self. Rather, it's a sort of a sovereign individualism, to use Tomislav Sunich's terminology. I think he says in the first chapter in Ride the Tiger here, that the real human type has nothing to do with the bourgeois world. Now, around his later works, Evola gets used to using more French terminology, which can put a lot of right-wing people off. He uses terms like bourgeois, and he even delves into his criticism of jazz and beatniks, things like that.
Right.
It's rather unique to hear someone like Evola talk about things like this. It's like, what? How? It's like watching a dog ride a bicycle. It's like you never would have thought that they would have delved into such a thing.
Right, but when he starts talking favorably about Henry Miller, for example, or something like this, you know, obviously in a very restricted sense, but Jack Kerouac, it's very, very peculiar.
Yeah, but to continue with the passage, he says in the first chapter, Ride the Tiger, he says, the differentiated man, the aristocrat of the soul, must consider everything bourgeois as being recent and anti-traditional, born from processes that in themselves are negative and subversive. In many cases, one can see in the present critical phenomena a kind of mimesis or rebound effect. And then he concludes with talking about the third estate here, where he says, this appears very clearly, for example, in the socioeconomic field through the obvious relationship between the bourgeois revolution of the third estate and the successive socialist and Marxist movements, through democracy and liberalism on the one hand and socialism on the other. The first revolution simply prepared the way for the second, whereupon the latter, having let the bourgeoisie perform that function, aimed solely at eradicating them. And that he says, the significance of the crises and the disillusions that so many people deplore today should be stated, indicating the real and direct object of the destructive processes, bourgeois civilization and society. But measured against traditional values, these latter were already the first negation of a world anterior and superior to them. Consequently, the crisis of the modern world could represent, in Hegel's terms, a negation of a negation. Mathematically speaking, a negative times a negative equals a positive. So that's what he advocates, a negation of a negation. He terms the modern world as a negation. So to negate the modern world is to, therefore, advocate for a positivity, that it may not end in nothingness, but if it does end in a nothingness, it's a nothingness that erupts in multiple forms of chaos, dispersion, rebellion, and protest that characterize many tendencies of recent generations, or in that other nothingness that is scarcely hidden behind the organized system of material civilization. And he says, for the differentiated man, alternatively, might create a new free space that could eventually become the premise for future formative action. And I think he sums it up quite brilliantly in his book, Revolt Against the Modern World, that let the modern man revel in their quote-unquote truths, and let us only be concerned with one thing, to keep standing amid a world of ruins.
Which is a very, very powerful image. It's one that he returns to in various of his works, this idea of standing, notwithstanding even against the flood that's coming, standing against all of the pressures that are being pushed on us, standing against the crumbling of our society and against the sheer ruin of everything that has been. He talks about this as well in certain works as a test, a kind of test that we're given to as human beings in modernity, that we should view the times in which we live as a spiritual trial in which we might prove ourselves and in which we might in some manner improve ourselves in the sense of actually coming to an awareness of what it means to be, to exist. You know, Evola is an interesting figure because he is one of these men who seems to be so utterly contradictory that he throws everybody off. Obviously, people on the left don't particularly like him for obvious reasons, but at the same time, he uses many of the terms of the left, as you pointed out, and this brings many people on the right to look at him with a kind of an evil eye or a degree of confusion or bewilderment, particularly because in some cases he seems to embrace what they would consider to be a collectivist perspective. He was a very deep spiritualist, and he was involved in many groups. At the time, he was a proponent of initiation and initiatory chains, as he put it. But at the same time, he doesn't present himself as, you know, your classic spiritual guru who retires from the world and goes to live in a cave somewhere to meditate on God or what have you. He presents himself as a warrior in a certain sense, one who fights against the changes that are coming, one who attempts to bring back into the world a traditional society, a right order. And, you know, I think that for many spiritualists, there would also appear to be something contradictory in this. He seems to have gotten to the point that he could see from the spiritualist perspective how small human affairs really are and how trivial our pursuits on this world really are. And yet at the same time, he kind of threw himself into the fray, and he was involved to a certain extent in, you know, the rise of fascism and things like this, and very political pursuits, which don't seem at all to correspond to a spiritualistic perspective. What do you think about that, Decadent? Do you think there is a contradiction in his thought here, or do you think that there's a way that they might be, that these two positions, spiritualism and a political existence, can be reconciled?
I think that's precisely the goal of Evola's philosophy, to reconcile the spiritual with the political. And I think he's pretty much succeeded in that in the most consistent and honest way as he could, from the information available to him, from the history, from the philosophy, from the mythology, from the ancient primordial interpretation and symbolism. It's quite a remarkable achievement, and I think it's the most notable one, if one is to say anything of his philosophy.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I guess I might phrase the question in a different sense. Evola, in turning to the tradition as an alternative to modernity, very, very radically stood against the idea of novelty, the idea of the new, the idea of originality in the kind of corrupted sense that we've taken it on. Because originality originally means returning to the origins or going back to the origins. In our modern sense, we mean being an origin, right? Presenting something that is fundamentally, radically, creatively new. And I think that we get this again from Nietzsche primarily. Evola, on the other hand, turns against innovation in that sense. And he almost implores us to return to unchanging principles. At the same time, it almost seems as if his philosophy presents a certain kind of synthesis of these two different perspectives, the perspective of returning to unchanging principles and the perspective of attempting to change the society in which we live. I think a great many spiritualists might simply look at the crumbling of society, consider it to be part of the cycle inherent to human societies, and to let well enough alone. The famous story of the Rosicrucians who came to Europe and then decided to depart almost immediately when they saw the French Revolution enact. This is an example of this kind of detachment and moving away from this sort of society, just letting things go. Whereas Evola is very determined to push, right? He takes Nietzsche's point very seriously that if something is falling, you must push it. That kind of activism certainly doesn't correspond with what a lot of people think about the spiritual perspective or being a spiritual man. Because spiritualism involves a retirement, a withdrawal from the world and from worldly things, whereas it seems like the fray of politics is a very worldly thing. How do you think that Evola saw it as something more than worldly?
Sort of something more than worldly. Well, I think, to coincide with what you're saying here, I think Evola's attempt to synthesize the spiritual with the political is brilliantly summed up again in his book Ride the Tiger, where he says that when a cycle of civilization is reaching its end, it is difficult to achieve anything by resisting it and by directly opposing the forces in motion. So here we can see that he is advocating the spiritual retirement as a form of activism in a way, which I think is a very interesting concept for Evola, very unique in and of itself. And he says that the current is too strong. And he's speaking of modern times. He says the current is too strong. One would be overwhelmed. The essential thing is not to let oneself be impressed by the omnipotence and apparent triumph of the forces of the epoch, that these forces, devoid of connection with any higher principle, are in fact on a short chain. He says one should not become fixated on the present and on things at hand, but keep in view the conditions that may come about in the future. Thus, the principle to follow could be that of letting the forces and processes of this epoch take their own course, while keeping oneself firm and ready to intervene when the tiger, which cannot leap on the person riding it, is tired of running. And I think that's fantastic. I think Evola perfectly summarized his entire philosophy, his entire activism, with that right there.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, it's a beautiful passage. There's no question. The intervention is the thing that really, really interests me. Because, I mean, to take another example, René Guénon, who is a man about whom I know less than I should. But Guénon was another spiritualist, another traditionalist of that period. In some ways, he was even Evola's master. I mean, in a certain sense, Evola took a great deal from his work. And Guénon, although he wrote books, he really withdrew to an extent and in a way that was much different from Evola's reaction to modernity. Guénon, moved to an Arabic country, and he was initiated into Sufism. And he, although he continued to contribute to various journals in Europe, and again, he wrote a number of works, he was really very disconnected from what was happening. And I believe, if I understand Guénon correctly, and it might be that I'm mistaking him, but his view of things is simply that modernity has reached such an extreme point that there is nothing to be done. One simply has to let it go, and there will be no opportunity for an intervention because the forces that are acting right now are superhuman, and the only thing that can be done is to let things go. The cycle will turn again, but it will turn by its own accord almost, right? There's no need for intervention. Evola, on the other hand, stayed in Europe. He was involved, as I mentioned, you know, in a very critical way, but involved nonetheless in the rise of fascism in Italy. This is one of the reasons that Evola is shunned from any kind of respectable intellectual community today. I mean, I think we might get a little bit into the historical question because it is very important. And it might shed some light on this idea, this problem of Evola's activism and what exactly he saw himself as doing in the world. Do you know much, Decadent, about his involvement in fascism or his involvement in that period of time?
Well, as a matter of fact, I do. That's why I'm on. But
right, absolutely.
It actually started right after he wrote Revolt Against the Modern World in 1934. The book does not necessarily gain much of a reception among the Italian intelligentsia, but it does gain some traction in Germany. And a year later, in 1935, it's given a German translation. And with that, Evola seals his place among the conservative revolutionary thinkers, even though he had been previously known by them through his through a translation of his book, A Pagan Imperialism, which he later denounced as a youthful utopian excess, which is an interesting critique from Evola. Very interesting choice of words there. Maybe it's just a translation, but I don't know. But he's...
No, it's loyal to the original.
Fascinating. Well, so in Germany, he's given a large reception. He's even asked to give lectures in Berlin and Vienna. And with that, he actually goes through a European tour, so to speak. He meets up with various political leaders and thinkers. He meets up with the Spanish phalangists and the Iron Guard in Romania. I believe this is all published in another publication from Arctos, The Traditionalist Confronts Fascism.
Exactly right.
Yeah. And, so, yeah, it's this gives a huge spike in his popularity. But at around this time, he's focusing on Buddhism. He's researching for his book, The Doctrine of Awakening, which is a sort of Buddhist asceticism of self-mastery kind of thing. And that's published in 1943. And but his most his real significant spike in popularity comes from his publications on race, The Myth of the Blood and The Synthesis. And the latter book, The Synthesis, is openly endorsed by Mussolini. And this actually grants Evola his own magazine called Blood and Spirit, which is solely dedicated to the race question. And at the time, it's published in both Italian and German. Now, unfortunately, this spike in popularity and quote-unquote state endorsement leads the majority of intellectuals to label Evola as a sort of race philosopher, which is clearly not the case. Again, like I said in the beginning, his philosophy envelops all kinds of topics from all kinds of periods of history. So Evola is consistently, from then on, considered a racial theorist, but reading his works, you can tell that Evola consistently considered race to be a rather secondary matter to his primary philosophy of traditionalism. Now, it might be interesting to note that Evola only met Mussolini once, and it was actually by coincidence. It was on the 8th of September, 1944, I believe, when, 1943? Oh, crap, I don't remember. I think it's 1944. Yeah, 1944.
I'm afraid I can't help you, but it must have been in that period. It was toward the end, at least, of the fascist regime. So
yes. Well, Evola happens to be in Germany at the time, and Mussolini is saved from his captives by a Scorsese, who's personally sent by Hitler to save Mussolini. And Mussolini comes back to Germany, and Evola is hanging out with a few fascist intellectuals there, and they're like, hey, Mussolini's here. And then that's when he finally meets him for the first time. And he proudly notes in The Path of Cinnabar that he was one of the first people to greet Mussolini. He seems a little proud of that. But I would be proud too if it was any political leader, frankly. But that's another topic. But around that time, soon afterward, after he meets Mussolini, he goes back to Rome, and Rome is under German occupation, and Evola senses a sort of collapse in Italy. Most people do at the time. So he secretly organizes what he calls a movement for the rebirth of Italy, which is unfortunately cut short from the occupation by the Allies in September 1944. So my mistake, it's 1943 that he meets Mussolini. And the Allied occupation forces Evola to move away to Vienna, and he attempts to revive the movement of a rebirth of Italy, which is again cut short in 1945 after the Allied occupation in Vienna. And during a bombing raid, Evola suffers a spinal injury, which partially paralyzes him. And this I think this is a significant turning point in his life because he was very huge on mountain climbing. He even dedicated a whole book to mountain climbing, Meditation on the Peaks, I think it's called. So makes it hard on him. But funny thing to note, the day after he wakes up from the hospital in Vienna after the bombing raid collapsed the building on top of him, he wakes up and he asks the nurse, have you seen my monocle? It's a famous little anecdote, but that's Evola for you. So that's a little quirky little anecdote for you. So he's in the hospital for 2 years. He returns to Italy in 1948, and he publishes his orientations in a magazine called Imperium, which is run by the Italian social movement. Then in 1950, a small fascist organization is disbanded by the Italian police under accusations of conspiring against the state in an attempt to revive a fascist Italy. All of it completely trumped up charges, frankly. And many of the men taken in to the police espouse ideas of Julius Evola's philosophy. So Evola is taken in, and he's accused as the quote-unquote leader of this conspiracy. And fortunately, he is released because obviously the charges were unfounded. And he gives a very memorable apologia in court that's included in the English translation of Men Among the Ruins. And again, Men Among the Ruins is probably his most complete political analysis. So if anyone is interested in solely his political ideas, Men Among the Ruins is the place to go. But if you want to get a well-rounded idea of his philosophy, books like Revolt Against the Modern World or Arctos' most recent publications of his work, Recognitions and Bone the Club, are a great place to start.
Yeah, I agree entirely with that. On both points, the Men Among the Ruins is absolutely the place to turn for his political vision. Revolt Against the Modern World is obviously his magnum opus, but at the same time, it's very, very dense. It's very, very long, and it's a little bewildering for somebody who has no idea of what he's proposing. You're kind of thrown into the middle of his vision of things without any kind of basis or background in it. So if there are any people listening to this who would like an introduction to Evola, I completely second Decadent's statements to that effect. The two works that Decadent mentioned are Recognitions and The Bow and the Club, which are recent publications from Arctos. They're both late works by Evola, which are compilations of essays. Some of these essays are essays that he wrote for various journals, and some of these essays are original pieces that were written specifically for the works in question. And they provide an overview of his positions on a great many topics, ranging from the political to the spiritual to the cultural, the artistic, historical. He touches on ancient Rome. He touches on a great many different topics, Epicureanism, just a vast array of things, which help one to enter into his vision of things in a kind of more organic way rather than just being thrown into the middle of it and having no idea where to begin with any of it. Coming back to the historical analysis, Decadent, I thank you for that. That was fantastic. I can't resist adding an anecdote about the bombing that fractured his spine. It might very well be apocryphal, but at the same time, given that Evola himself thought very highly of the importance of myth, I think that I'm justified in presenting it. The story has it that Evola was actually wandering the streets during a bombing raid testing his destiny, and the result of that was the bomb that paralyzed him. So
yeah, that's actually not true. that's a rumor.
It's not true. Perfect. Well, nonetheless, yeah, I present it as if it were true, and I insist on its importance as a myth. So
yeah, but he was simply working on some research in his room, and that's as simple as that. That rumor was actually started by one of his friends, and Rene Ganon actually believed it to an extent, and he had to he actually had to contact Ganon and say, hey, that's not true.
Well, nonetheless,
myth crushed from interregnum.
Ah, there we are, exactly. Although, I kind of wish it weren't. I'm a little bit skeptical about our insistence on historical accuracy in some respects, but nonetheless, Decadent, I appreciate that you're so well informed on this that you could immediately refute my mistaken anecdote. Right. So, perhaps just as we approach the close of this podcast, we could come back to that aspect of Evola's life, because I really do think that there's something very, very important about the way that Evola lived his life. A kind of criticism that can be brought against many intellectuals and maybe a few philosophers is that they don't live in a way that's befitting to their beliefs. You know, this is particularly true of modern day armchair radicals who espouse different ideas, but then, you know, you learn that they practically live in an extraordinarily conventional bourgeois fashion in big apartments and, you know, plush locales and important cities, and they live in a way which has nothing at all to do with what they believe. Evola's life is a representation of what he believed, and this is one of the things that I think anyone should be able to respect about the man, was his coherency and his consistency. And I think that there's a lot to be learned about Evola's thought by viewing his life, which is, again, why I appreciate so much, Decadent, that you were able to present us a crash course in Evolian biography.
Yes, but I have to briefly mention, right before Mussolini endorsed Evola's views on race, that was actually a very controversial thing at the time, because Evola was already criticized for his criticism of fascism in his articles in La Torre, which actually only lasted a few months because he received so much backlash from that magazine. This was around the early 1930s. He received so much backlash and death threats from his criticisms that he actually had to hire bodyguards to feel safe in his own country.
Yeah, and the same thing happened with his views on race, which are perhaps one of the most unique parts of his entire work, but we might be able to talk a little bit more about that. But at any rate, after Mussolini was presented with his books, which Evola actually viewed as a way of contributing to the fascist regime, which was being built in a way, and in the hopes of revitalizing Italy. That's a very complicated subject, though. But anyway, the point being that when it came to the attention of certain individuals that those works have been presented to Mussolini, they immediately attempted to intervene and to convince Mussolini that he shouldn't have anything to do with Evola. And this is this entire drama was interrupted by the outbreak of the war and what subsequently happened, the fall of the fascist regime, et cetera, et cetera. But Evola, during that entire period, you're absolutely right to emphasize this point, Decadent, he maintained his independent perspective, and he could never by any means be considered, you know, a fascist stooge or something of the sort. He was very critical of fascism in a number of very interesting ways. They're not at all conventional critiques of fascism. So that's absolutely important to say.
Yeah, but it's also important to emphasize that Evola wasn't completely against fascism. He saw fascism as an opportunity for a revival of traditionalism, but not necessarily an end point.
Exactly. He considered it hopeful in some ways, that he considered it to be potential. And I think that he saw absolutely the possibility that fascism would simply propel Italy down the road that it had already been going down toward, you know, a continual abasement. And it might have ended up just as kind of an alternative path on the downward way of modernity. But at the same time, he did see certain elements in fascism which had the promise of renovating Italy and bringing Italy back to what he considered to be an appropriate political order. So, yeah, I mean, the point being that he was neither pro-fascist nor anti-fascist in any kind of way that most people would understand. He had a very nuanced idea of fascism.
Yeah, I don't know what to say to that. I agree.
Right, okay. So at this point, I think we can start to wrap things up. Decadent, you've given us a very, very fine overview of a very complicated and very profound thinker, and I appreciate it very much. Is there anything that you'd like to say in closing about Evola's importance, either to you personally or to the world? Any closing remarks you might have?
I can only say that his philosophy has been a huge influence on my Weltanschauung, my perspective of the world, on life and things, and not just politically, but personally and just life in general. I think one can find very beautiful things as well as very absolute things. You can see a beauty in his works, but also a strictness in his works. I think that in a way opens up one's mind, ironically, when it comes to Evola, even though his philosophy does not allow very much wiggle room. He, in a way, liberates one's mind when looking at the world around them, and just such a unique view on things that it would, at the very least, demand that you question everything that you had previously thought of in terms of the modern world, in terms of society, in terms of your own personal living. He's just that influential. And I think he will always be important. And the day that he's forgotten is the day that we have lost something important in human thought.
Finally said, Decadent. Finally said. It's absolutely right what you just said. I think that anyone who believes them in any aspect of our modern world, very, very profoundly, very deeply, you know, be it capitalism, be it liberalism, be it democracy, communism, any of these political alternatives that we have today, whether they're the ones that we presently live under or proposed ideals, the entirety of the Enlightenment, anyone who actually adheres to these things and is intellectually open enough to see them challenged as deeply as they can be, you know, even if it's only as a means of reinforcing their own ideas and understanding exactly what it is they believe with a certain degree of, you know, with an increased clarity, which I think is a task that should be pursued by all of us. We should all be attempting to arrive at that clarity. Anyone who would like increased clarity on their modern positions should absolutely turn to Evola and attempt to understand the critique that he presented of modernity, because he is certainly one of the greatest critics of modernity that ever was. And, you know, I would also like to say in closing that it's, in my mind, it's a very good sign to see young men like yourself, Decadent, who are picking up the works of Evola and trying to understand it. And you've obviously done a fantastic job with it. My compliments. Evola thought very highly of the importance of the youth. I mean, in some of these last works that Arctos has published, he has a number of essays which are dedicated to trying to understand the meaning of youth and the importance of youth. And he had a very strong pedagogical streak at the end of his life, trying to bring young people into a clearer vision of the world in which they're living and the kinds of actions and perspectives that make sense in our time. So having said that, I would like to give you an opportunity, Decadent, to say a word on your projects right now, anything you're working on, to say once again where people can find you. You have a lot of extremely interesting things to say, so I encourage people to look you up, and I'd like to give you an opportunity to say where they can do that.
All right. Well, I have a YouTube channel under the same name, Decadent Perspective. What I'm working on at the moment is actually a sort of six-part series on an in-depth analysis on the major works of Julius Evola, so look forward to that. I'm also writing a book at the moment that I hope to get published soon, if not by Arctos. Maybe you guys can put a good word for me, I don't know. But I'm also, so there's that I'm working on. I'm also have a Twitter under the same name, Decadent Perspective, where I have small little inquiries on certain topics. And I also have a Gab as well, same name, Decadent Perspective, where I mainly just post quotes from various philosophers. And if I had any message to advocate is read more than you do at the moment.
Oh, man, I second that entirely. All right, so we have a couple of news items to close up with. Before we get to that, is there anything else we'd like to say about Evola or anything to add to the general podcast that we've submitted today?
I think we went through it all brilliantly.
Great, all right. Martin, anything to add?
No, actually, just a really lovely time listening to a rather very interesting conversation. So you've persuaded me to go back and dust off my Evola books and delve back into them.
Fantastic. Okay, and with that, I'd like to mention that once again, we're in the midst of publishing the books of our recent Evola campaign, which included four titles, four original translations of previously untranslated works. These being Recognitions, which is Evola's last published work, Bow in the Club, The Myth of the Blood, and The Mask and Face of Contemporary Spiritualism. We've already said quite a few things about Recognitions and the Bow and the Club, which have been published now for a fair amount of time. The Myth of the Blood has just recently been published, and I encourage people to go and take a look at that. Very, very briefly, it is Evola's, to my mind, peerless analysis and overview of the racialist thought of his era, which includes the ideas that led to the racialism of his time. It presents the major theorists behind race of the past 300 or 400 years. It actually extends a deal farther back than that, but most of his concentration is on the modern period. It talks a lot about the science which is involved in it. Obviously, some of these things are a little dated because he was writing this back during the fascist period. And there's been a lot of work on race that's been done since then with considerably newer science. But nonetheless, Evola gives a perspective which I don't think many of our scientists would be able to. So that's absolutely worth checking out. It's also a means of attempting to understand the ideas that we're working with today and that we're trying to come to terms with today surrounding ideas like race, which obviously is an enormously controversial and an enormously troubled part of the modern world. So it's the kind of work that gives us a clearer understanding of our own positions. The final work that we're going to be publishing in the near future is The Mask and Face of Contemporary Spiritualism. We'll certainly have more to say about that when the time comes to actually publish it, but it is Julius Evola's criticism of the spiritualistic currents of his time. So this goes into pretty much all of the big figures who at that time were either posturing or actually genuinely attempting to renovate spiritualism, anthroposophy, and theosophism, and all of these kinds of movements, which began in Evola's day, but they continue to some extent even today. There are a lot of people who still read these works, and they have a lot.
Don't read the book if you're a fan of Deepak Chopra.
Absolutely. Yeah. Unfortunately, due to certain historical accidents, Evola wasn't able to critique Deepak Chopra. But in any case, so that's a very interesting work, and it's a very interesting window into Julius Evola's own spiritualism, because as with all of Evola's critique, it moves beyond critique. It begins from a basis of analysis, but it transcends that basis and moves to the principles from which Evola himself lived and worked. So that is all that needs to be said for that. At the close of our Evola campaign, Arctos will be the foremost publisher of Evola titles in the world. So that's absolutely an exciting development for Arctos Media. And I encourage everyone to look those titles up. With that, Martin, I believe you had some news as well.
Yes, as with regards to other non-Evola but Evola-related titles, riding off the back of the last podcast, Mark Dial's book, Hated and Proud, Ultras Contra Modernity, is now available for physical purchase from the Arctos store and I believe Amazon as well, with all the usual hardback, softback, ebook, Kindle variations. So absolutely worth, as we previously mentioned, checking out. There's a strain of Nietzschean and Evolian thought in discussions with some of the ultras, and I think that ties in very nicely with some of the concepts we've been discussing today. So that is Mark Dial's book, Hated and Proud, Ultras Contra Modernity, available now for purchase.
Absolutely, and I'll mention it as well again that our last podcast featured Mark Dial, and Mark Dial is certainly a man who can be considered as one who lives what he thinks. So just to continue that particular theme of today's conversation.
Undoubtedly.
All right. So with that, Decadent, thank you very much for joining us today. I certainly hope that we have an opportunity to have you on again. This has been fascinating and enlightening, and I very much appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad to have contributed in some way. Thank you.
All right, so thank you all for listening, and we'll see you again in just about 2 weeks with our next podcast. With that, goodbye to everyone.